don't know if that picked up on the microphone, but that's the sound of a nice fire popping in the background here from Recovery Internet Radio, broadcast direct from the brand new and wonderful Straight Up Studios. It's a cold night. We've got a fire going inside, and we've got some great conversation ahead for episode number 42. I want to pass it along to our host this week and every week, Mr. Rick Atwater.
Remember the Arsenio Hall show? Didn't they do that?
People still do that.
Yeah, they still do that. Hi and welcome everybody to the show tonight. Our tag is "Don't leave before the miracle happens," and that was really basically Julie's idea. I think it was "Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens," but I had to shorten it up for technical reasons. But you got the point, and I think we're gonna. You'll understand the title, I think, better as we go. But thanks for joining us tonight, where we are every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, where we've been, I think, almost really for the last year. I don't know if it's our anniversary, but it's darn close to it.
We should celebrate. I mean, we should have cake and muffins. What happened?
Cake and muffins. What were we thinking? How about next? We'll do that next week.
Okay, all right.
We'll have muffins next week. Sorry, you guys, but you know, next week. Thank you to Chris, our engineer.
Sir.
And I think we got him. Do we have him turned around in better condition, John?
It feels a little more comfortable over there. I see that this is nonverbal communication that can go on between you guys, you know. So.
Yeah, for those of you at home, you know, we've got a new studio and some new equipment, and I think I was facing the wrong way. So.
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, we got him turned around. We got him back in the mix. We got the engineer back in the mix.
If I sounded weird the last couple of weeks, I was backwards. That's why.
So, let's see. You can call in if you have a question or a concern or an opinion, or you just have plain old something to say. And our call-in number is 323-792-2977. That's 323-792-2977. Somebody remind me to say that again at halftime.
Oh, so I gotcha.
You got it?
I got it.
You can also tweet us at Rick Atwater. And you can do that live so we can get your tweets during the show if you have questions.
Yeah, if you're shy, you don't want to call, you know, we'd love
right.
You can play along.
A tweet will work.
We're broadcasting.
Also, remember to check out recoveryinternetradio.com for all our archive shows and recovery resources. That is
recoveryinternetradio.com.
Okay, so I think we got that covered. We have a couple of mentions we'd like to make of some of our friends who have businesses in the area.
This is Mo. You know, I really want to speak from my heart about Chris Atwater. Chris, the name of his business is Atwater Health and Wellness. He does personal fitness and nutritional coaching. And I can personally tell you that I hired him, and it was amazing to be around someone who listened, number one, to my real issues, and then created a program that I could believe in. In other words, it wasn't just a cookie cutter sort of thing. So when he just said we would have cake and muffins, I can guarantee we would not be having just ordinary cake and muffins here. He would be scanning for something healthy because that's who he is.
It would be sugar-free carrot muffins.
So he really individualizes his
program, find a balance.
Whether it be an individualized exercise program, which he's done for me, which has been extremely helpful. And he's also done special foods for me because I have needs for it. So I really hope you'll consider calling him.
And how do you get a hold of him?
You call. I can read it, 224-623-4085.
Okay.
And you don't have to sign up when you call. That's the cool thing. He'll just talk to you about it. So I encourage you to do so.
Thank you, Mo.
Is that good?
That was very good.
How was it, Chris?
That was fantastic.
Okay. All right. Mo's first ad.
You're hired.
We have a couple of other friends we'd like to mention, but I think we're going to, in the interest of getting rolling here, I think we'll save that for the end of our show if we have time, because I'd like to introduce Julie M. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Hi, Julie.
I'm glad you could come tonight.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you for coming out on this chilly evening. And I know that you, we had a chance to talk before, and you've shared some of your poetry with me, and you mentioned that you were a poet, a writer, and have had some things published. And so I'd love to start, because I think that your poetry captures a lot of what you feel and a lot of who you are. So I wanted to incorporate that into our show tonight. So I thought it would be a good place to start. Which poem would you like to start with?
Well, I'll start with one called Ghosts.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. I wrote this one at the very beginning, I think. It's called Ghosts. Ghosts. Sometimes my memory is unkind, and I think about those sad events that never fades with time. And so it goes with me wherever I seem to go. People try to touch me, and I avoid the blow. But I was never guilty, nor was I set free. Your ghost still drinks and stalks my mind and preys upon my dreams.
Thank you. That was good. Can we talk a little bit about your how you got going with the writing and and what that's doing for you?
Well, it actually kind of ties into my growing up, too. Grew up in an alcoholic family, and I'm older, so we didn't have, TV as we know it today. We had, an old clunker with the rabbit ears, and you only got a couple of channels, and mostly it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But we did have books. Mm-hmm. And so I pretty much retreated to books. And so I spent a lot of time reading and a lot of time. Actually, it was only what was available, which were a lot of old books and poetry. Mm-hmm. So I started by just connecting. I think the poets were saying things, even though I was a really little kid then, I was hearing things that the poets were saying that the adults in my life weren't saying. Things like Emily Dickinson, I hide myself within a flower, that fading from your vase, you unsuspecting feel for me almost a loneliness. And I thought, I was a little kid, and I'm like, oh my gosh. I could tell that when I go to school that my teachers and people were feeling bad or sad or something about me, but nobody was saying. But I could tell that they unsuspectingly felt something about me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really gravitated to poetry and started writing.
Mm-hmm. Have you had some things published?
Mm-hmm, I have. A couple of things in, literary arts magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Did a book a couple of years ago with an artist friend of mine, and she did paintings, and we did my poetry, and it's called Landscapes for the Soul.
Mm.
And so we did that. I'm working on a novel and other books and poetry.
Well, you're busy.
Mm-hmm, very. And music. I write music, too.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the last thing that we're going to say for the end, I know, but is actually a song
it
you're
is.
Going to read. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because it finally is catching up with me that you were saying song, not poem. And so, okay.
Yeah, and it's really kind of interesting because most of my poems don't rhyme, but most of my music does. I have no idea why.
Different part of the brain or something.
I
don't really know.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe it sounds like a simple question, but was the poetry that you wrote, was that therapeutic for you to do it? Was it helpful?
Yeah, it was. Sure, it was, because it's like giving that voice to what's going on, and
when you couldn't do it another way?
Yeah. It's like, I think, being a little kid, it's hard to articulate your stuff, for sure. So to read people like Emily Dickinson or other writers, you'd say, oh, my gosh, they said what I'm feeling.
Mm.
And the older I got, the better I got at identifying what it was for me. And it's always interesting, you know, music or poetry is just to sit down. And I don't always sit down and say, well, today I'm going to write a poem or I'm going to write a, you know, a song. It's a feeling that, mm-hmm. you know, okay, maybe I have one line in my head or I hear a melody and I say, what is it? And sometimes I'm very critical of myself. I say, oh, that sounds corny. But if I follow it where I go, wherever it goes, a lot of times I'm just like shocked at the end. It's like, I didn't know I felt that. I had no idea that stuff was that deep inside of me.
So you're painting a picture with words and you don't know what the picture is going to be until you're done with it.
Not at all.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Yeah, I get that. So so maybe we can move. So actually I had the question to ask you, could you paint us a picture? Could you begin to paint us a picture of your childhood?
Mm. Yeah. Well, the beginning of it probably turned out was the beginning looked okay. It doesn't always make sense to me, mostly, but my dad was in the seminary. He was going to be a priest when he met my mom, who wanted to be a nun. And I say, I don't know what happened, but they got married, decided to become alcoholics, and hit the fan. And it was, like you say, you know, the beginning part of it may have been kind of okay, but in another poem that I wrote, I said, by the time I was seven, my childhood was over, and it was, at least the way that I think childhood should be. My uncle had been killed in Vietnam on Christmas Day, and my dad and the whole family just never, ever got out of that. There was already, you know, some serious problems with drinking going on, but this just really poured, you know, like Miracle Grow on the whole thing. My dad ended up coming and going, and eventually leaving my mom for a prostitute. And to her credit, really, she said, no, you can't come back, go, and filed for divorce, but when divorce was not a popular thing to do.
And you had how many sibs did you have?
I had one brother and one sister.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and after my dad left, my mom's drinking got worse, I suspect. You know, which is an odd thing to say because I never connected any of the behavior, like, to the drinking, and it wasn't until I was in junior high, because that's just what it always was.
So you didn't, it wasn't like you thought your mom was an alcoholic. You did.
No. And it wasn't like, oh, she's drinking again, here we go. No, they drank all the time forever. I don't remember them ever not drinking. So,
right, so it's, you know, normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. But things got worse in terms of, like, the house got dirty. My dad didn't pay child support. So we didn't have clothes. We didn't have food. You know, we were filthy dirty. You know, I just remember things like, you know, there must not have been a brush in the house. I remember having to cut the mats out of my hair. And, of course, being, you know, teased like crazy at school. And, you know, things like, you know, is that the only, you know, you wear that every day. Is that the only thing you have to wear? And mm-hmm. the answer is yes. You don't say that to the kids.
Right.
You ditch school instead whenever you can.
Right.
So, yeah, stuff like that was, and lots of violence. You know, my mom was a very violent person. And that's pretty much the way that it went.
Mm-hmm. And when you were in school, did any other than being dirty and wearing the same clothes, did anybody notice that things weren't right?
You know, I'm sure the other kids did because, I mean, we really were, you know, like malnourished, no mm-hmm. doubt. I know the other kids did. I'm sure the teachers did, like I said.
But nobody did anything about it?
People didn't get involved like they do today. I mean, today, DCFS would be all over it. But people minded their own business. You know, years later, I had a friend. She was our neighbor, like two doors down. And she said, they would hear my mom just beating the living daylights out of us, and they would just, her and her sister would beg their mom, you've got to do something. And she'd say, no, that's their business, and we stay out of that.
Hmm.
You know, and that's really the way it was.
Yeah.
Like, I know, like, other kids knew, because we didn't have, we didn't go to school with lunch, and I'm sure that my mom would have qualified for, you know, a free lunch program, and whether she knew about that or didn't fill out paperwork, I don't know. But
how do you think that looking back on it now, knowing what you know, how do you think that was affecting you at that point?
Well, it was, well, you know, I remember being terribly, terribly hungry. You know, couldn't concentrate, didn't have glasses to see, you know, the board. But I remember being a mooch, you know, that's what they would call you, because you'd just be begging the other kids, like, hey, you got, you know, a dime, a nickel, whatever. You try to get money from them, because they had a couple of vending machines. And a good day was when I could get one of those pizza puffs for 35 cents.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because that would hold you.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't count on it. And so it was hard, because you didn't want to be mooching from people.
No. Were you ashamed of that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't want to be, you're like, I wouldn't be, you'd never say this, but there's no way you could pay him back the next day or the next week.
No.
Ever.
No. We might tell him that, though.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, I mean, and then that's hard when, you know, when you, another kid doesn't have to go through all of that. They don't have to be a mooch. They don't have to be ashamed of being a mooch. They don't have to be ashamed of not having clothes. They don't have to be ashamed that they have to, you know, say they need money that they'll pay back, that they can't pay back. You know, all of that stuff, that's baggage that a lot of kids didn't carry.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a, you know, I mean, that's a pretty full backpack for, how old are we talking? We're talking prior to junior high?
Oh, yeah.
And I bet you, you know, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are, but I bet you weren't the only one in your class that was carrying the same backpack. It's just that you didn't know, you wouldn't have known each other.
No, you know, and it wasn't until junior high that, because divorce wasn't popular back then, but it was starting to be. It was the 60s. And so a couple other kids in the neighborhood, that started happening. And so like those two girls I talked about, well, their parents were divorced. And then there was a couple more kids. And we all started hanging around together. Why? Because we couldn't play with the other kids, because our family had problems.
Right.
And so we'd hang with them. You know, and it's sad, you know, that things were going on, like, in some of those homes, and some of the guys from there, out of all our childhood friends, my brother is the only male survivor. They're all dead. Yeah. From, you know, the violence of addiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard living and hard drinking and the whole thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was other kids.
So when did you find out what the problem was, and how did you find out?
I found out it was in junior high. A friend of mine had said, come to Baptist church with her. We sing songs and we have a good time. It was a youth group, and I didn't have anything better to do, so I went with her. And
you mean you weren't a Baptist?
I wasn't a Baptist.
Just on Sunday?
But I tell you, I have a special place in my heart for them. Because this guy would pick up these kids, and he'd pick up, go to these houses, and these straggly little kids coming out, these dirty kids coming out, just looking just like us. It was like crazy. But, you know, he came over to our house. I want to say I was in junior high then. And, you know, he came over to pick us up. My mom said I couldn't go out. Don't know why. And he just yelled at her, and he pointed at her, and he said, lady, you are an alcoholic, and you are sending your children to hell. And she literally beat the out of him.
It's internet radio. You can say whatever you want.
And she just let him have it.
Yeah.
She just let him have it. And the guy was crumpled up, and he finally got out, and there's a whole busload of kids waiting out there. And really, to his credit, he came back the next week to pick me up, see if I could go that week. But, you know, I had heard that word, you know, alcoholic. I never connected it to my mom, even though everybody, they just always drank. And it was when he said it, I thought, what in the world? And, you know, I started thinking about it, and I talked to a friend of mine. She said, oh, yeah, I think your mom's definitely an alcoholic. And, of course, years later, you know, a lot of years later, a friend of mine would say, Julie, you have no idea how terrified I was to just come over to your house.
Why was she terrified?
Because of the violence in
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
It was a scary place to be.
And you had no role. That was just the way it was for you.
It was the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was scared there. Definitely I was scared there, but that's just the way it was.
So the light started going on for you at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you do anything about that or with that information, or what happened?
No. Mm-mm. No, not for a long time. I do remember I worked at a hospital driving a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth.
Yeah, we worked at the same hospital.
That's right.
Not too many years apart.
That's anyway. Right. And so I would take people from the emergency room by the bus over to the mental health unit. So I had a lot of the counselors were riding my bus to pick up people. And I remember them starting to talk about adult child alcoholics and dysfunctional families because there's a lot of downtime on the bus, too.
Yeah.
So you'd talk.
That must have been like late 70s, early 80s in there somewhere?
Yeah, like mid-80s, actually.
Mid-80s.
Mm-hmm. And so I remember one of the guys talking, and he said, wow, you know, what? That's kind of like what I grew up in. And he said, well, maybe you should check out these meetings. And I said, yeah, well, you know, I'm already grown up, though.
Yeah.
I think I got a pretty good handle on it. So it really wasn't, until 1991 that I worked with a woman who was going to those meetings, and her and I took lunch together every day, and she said, well, you grew up in the same thing. You got to go. So I always laugh when I say, you know, program of attraction, because
mm-hmm.
she badgered me to death into going. And I am grateful for her for doing that.
Yeah.
Like people who come on their own, walk in the door all by themselves, I don't know how they do that, because I wouldn't have been able to,
So we were talking about, you as a junior high school student, which probably makes you, 10, 11, 12 in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you went all the way through high school.
Mm-hmm.
Did you finish high school? How did that work out for you?
Oh, no.
No?
No.
No.
No, I didn't. I mean, not until, I went back and got my GED when I was 30.
Yeah.
By that time, there was lots of craziness, and my dad had actually taken me to court to make me an emancipated minor because I had a part-time job, and like I say, he didn't want to pay child support to my mother. We did get evicted out of our house when I was in eighth grade, and I was trying, sort of. Wasn't really into school. It was not really until the last year that I started.
What were you into?
Just what everybody else was, partying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you could not have grown up in my house and not got high.
Yeah.
You just couldn't have.
Yeah.
You know.
Wouldn't work that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you kind of mentioned that in some of your poetry indicates that you were more the parent than your parents. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And, and I was also a kid trying to fit in. So I was really interested when I was a little kid. Maybe it's because I did have some church or whatever, but I knew that God existed for me, even in all of that insanity. Come high school, I'd do things like I'd smoke a joint and go to Bible study. So they were like, what?
It's kind of like having a drink and reading the big book.
Yeah,
it's kind of...
You're a hypocrite, goody-goody. And so I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in with my friends. I didn't fit in with...
But you were looking for something.
I was.
And didn't even really know you were looking, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that funny?
Poetry and just trying to find your way.
So that's what high school looked like for you. A lot of partying, a lot of trying to fit in, a lot of taking care of your parent or taking care of your mom. Was your mom getting worse?
She was, but I don't know that I was taking care of her. I think I was more like avoiding her.
Staying away from home?
Yeah,
because, I mean, you had to be really careful about who you brought there. She was naughty, very naughty. And she wouldn't think twice about, you know, hitting somebody else or doing really inappropriate things.
Hmm.
Really inappropriate. So, I mean, you had to be very careful about.
Like, who could you bring?
The other dysfunctional kids.
Somebody who's probably living in a family very similar to yours, so
yeah,
they'd understand
absolutely.
If your mom
absolutely.
Took a swing at him or
and,
something.
You know,
or,
and we would actually, we'd take turns who was going to keep her out of trouble. You know, go keep her company in the kitchen. That was it.
Hmm.
We just kind of tried to do
it. What were your brother and sister doing at that time? Were you older?
I was the oldest.
Yeah. What were they doing?
The same thing.
Yeah.
Everybody, like I say, you couldn't have grown up in our house and that got high. When my mom, she had to go off for surgery, I think we were in eighth grade. And my dad, you know, like I say, he was an alcoholic too. And I remember him just bringing us a case of beer. You know, it's like, now if I was in eighth grade, and not my sister was in seventh and my brother was in sixth. So,
mm-hmm.
And, but that's just the way it was. My dad loved to fish. We went to Canada every year.
Mm-hmm.
And from the time we could hold a fishing pole. And as soon as you crossed, you know, into Canada, it was like, get beer. And, you know, so we were drinking pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That's just the way it was.
So your mom went to have surgery and your dad got you a case of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that everybody can...
I mean, that would make sense to certain people.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody.
Yeah.
But a lot of people would understand.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, okay. So it sounds like you were pretty much on your own as
mm-hmm.
far as, you know, yeah. Yeah, the Wild West in Julie's house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think what we'll do is maybe we'll stop here. And I know we were talking about music, and music is pretty important to you. And you mentioned a couple of songs. So we'll take a break. What do we got?
Coming at you from 1972, Hold Your Head Up by Steppenwolf.
Okay. And how much time does that give us? Give
we'll
or take?
Be back with you in about 5 minutes.
All right. So we're going to play Hold Your Head Up. So let her rip. now sort of like more about recovery and how you got into it and how that works for you, but I thought it would be a good thing to start with another poem that you'd written. What's the poem?
Okay. This one is called It's Not Locked, and I like this because it is. It starts to move into the recovery part. I mean, you listen to a lot of that other stuff, and it's pretty dismal, and that's not where it's hard to go there because I don't think about that much anymore.
Not where you hang out?
That isn't where I hang out. But this is neat because it shows where I eventually start moving to. It's not locked. My father never opened the door to my home. When it would rain, I would wait by the window and look down the lane, and I would see him standing under the street lamp, standing alone in the light of the rain. It seems so sad to know now that I always felt older than him, that I would reach for him, but he could not hold me up or even hold my hand. I knew that. And yet some part of me had to try to make him my father. Some part of me was both wife and mother to him. And I would call him in from the rain and light a fire and bring him warm soup. Still, he was not nourished. I still see him standing in the rain, vacant. I still wait by the window, needing him. And sometimes I call him in, but my father will not open the door to my home. And maybe, just maybe, his wound is deeper than mine.
Hmm. That's good. Can you say how, maybe talk a little bit about how that poem relates to your recovery? And how, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, as I was going to meetings, I started going to, I got in first going to Adult Children of Alcoholics and eventually ended up in Al-Anon, which is where I'm still at today.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was going there, just really learning about it being a disease. One of the things that was so helpful was to find out, this is why I am the way that I am. I mean, I knew I didn't fit in with anybody, but I didn't quite know why. I kept trying to make myself fit in. And but I learned, you know, about my family, too, in the disease of addiction. Mm-hmm. And so along with that, in the programs, too, you know, we say this in Al-Anon, too, is that our purpose is to help families of alcoholics. And we do that by practicing the 12 steps ourselves and by giving compassion and understanding to the alcoholic. So it was really important for me to, you know, see that as the disease that it was.
And I do hear the compassion in the poem.
Oh, it's there.
Yeah.
It's there. Now, I have to say also, by the time this was written, when I was 17 years old, my mom got into recovery.
Mm-hmm.
She had gotten carted off on a bad date, so to speak. But, you know, it's amazing. She never drank again. And I don't know how she didn't do that. I don't know how she didn't do that. She didn't have any family who was there to support her. She didn't have all the neighbors she drank with. She didn't have anybody but AA. And then, you know, when she started getting sober, she looked around and saw how messed up her kids were. And, you know, my dad, what do you do with that? But she never drank. She never drank again. And she worked her program. So I was getting, you know, bits, you know, that ripple effect.
Right.
You know, that ripple effect. You know, when we say, you know, that, you know, by coming to Al-Anon, it can make a difference in your life, even if the alcoholic is still drinking, which is a lot of, ha, what do you mean? Get out. But it's true. I mean, because once you start changing, you know, that change, the attitudes, a recovery, once you start changing, people can't react to you the same way they did before.
Was she still drinking when you got into recovery, or had she stopped She had stopped at the time you started?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did your dad ever recover?
No, he didn't. He had, you know, lots and lots of DUIs. He eventually burned down his place where he lived, fell asleep drinking and smoking, and he eventually had a stroke, and he died a few years ago. But never. He was he went court ordered to treatment.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what do you think of that, Dad? How's that going for you? That's a bunch of shit. All right, man.
He never did.
No.
But
involuntary sometimes.
Yeah.
Involuntary.
Yeah, there you go. But you got started. How did you actually get started? You were talking about this lady that badgered you into your first ACLI meeting.
She badgered me in there, and I went because I knew she would be there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm a bit of an introvert.
Yeah.
And I think I would have been too scary to go alone. I went. I heard. I said, oh, my gosh, this is me. This is me. And it was scary. And sometimes I couldn't really come for weeks at a time because it was too much. And, you know, just had to let it sink in. But I was compelled to go back and find out more.
So what was sinking in? What were you finding out?
The disease of alcoholism. Also, you know, this was in the 90s, too, so there was a lot of really good people out there, too. John Bradshaw was a huge body of black. So we had a Bradshaw group at our meetings. And so we did, you know, the homecoming recovery workbook, and it was huge because you have other people who are going through the same stuff, and it is, it's transforming.
And they talk about inner child work, reclaiming your inner child. Could you say a little bit about what that means? Because I think there's people out there that wouldn't understand that.
The way that I would say it is that, you know, we grow older. But there's always, what's the word I'm looking for? No matter our age, you know, we still have that child inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that never goes chronologically, that's the word.
Yeah.
Chronologically, we grow older, but that child is still there. I mean, they're still there. They are wounded, or they are in wonder and awe. There's all kinds of things going on with that child. And what that helped me to do was be able to go and tend to that wounded child as the adult and start learning how to be more of an adult, because I think a lot of my reactions were coming from, you know, woundedness too. And so go back and do some of that healing. And just keep healing and loving and getting... you know, your self-worth that you didn't know. You just thought you were damaged. You were worthless.
Did your relationship with your mom change, improve?
It did. She moved from a person, and she's truly the only person I ever in my life have hated, truly hated. And she moved from a person that I love the most. And when you ask about recovery heroes, I mean, it's her. I mean, what's possible? I mean,
you never would have dreamed in a million years that she would have stayed sober, did you?
No. And to be the loving person that she ended up being.
Right. So, this may not be an answerable question, but how can you get from hate to love? How can you get from hating somebody that much to being able to have them be your hero and love them? How did you do that?
Well,
did you do that?
Yeah. I think you do it by working the program and by having your higher power. You do that by having a sponsor.
Who encourages you along the way?
Because, you know, you think it's all you. It's like there's always this, I'm damaged, or something's wrong with me, something's wrong with me. But you just keep coming back. You just keep coming back, and you work the program. I don't know that I did it so much as that my higher power did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, used me to do that.
And it's a nice tie into the title of the show when you said keep coming back, because I think maybe... You hear that in the 12-step circles, keep coming back, but I think the rest of the sentence is keep coming back until the miracle happens.
Yeah.
And that's a miracle. What you're describing is a miracle.
It is, because I cannot tell you how much I love my mother and admire her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, admire her for, you know, not only her, you know, my sister, John L. will be anonymous. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who have had to struggle with this and how, I mean, you just see the suffering. It's amazing. It's just amazing. But for me to be able to love her, and I also have to say my dad, too. He did die a couple years ago. And, you know, when he had the stroke, you know, I called up my brother and said, you know, Dad had a stroke. He was in Chicago at the time. And he said, Josh, you know, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I really hardly know the guy. And I said, I know, I'm not asking you to do anything. I'm just telling you. But, you know, through a series of things, I ended up moving him out closer to me to a nursing home there, which was really weird because, you know, I was not his favorite. My sister was, but I was not.
Yeah.
And he didn't get this whole recovery thing. He was not particularly nice to me. I don't know that he ever loved me. I just don't. But, you know, the thing is that when he was dying, I went and they said, well, it's going to be any minute now. And it actually took him more like 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at his bedside the whole time. And it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember right before that thinking, okay, God, well, I can take him anytime now. But I kept getting this message, no, I really want you to love him. And I thought, okay, I love him. No, I want you to really love him. And it's like I had to go deeper into that love. And for me to be with him, because he had nobody at his bedside. He didn't have people coming to visit him. He had burned a lot of bridges. And when he died, you know, I guess I just thought, you know, that it was Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was AA. It's the 12 steps.
What kept you there. That's what kept you.
You know, it's not anything that I did. It's because the program, Bill Wilson,
because
he was there, you know, and otherwise, my dad would have died alone. I know that because I could have had plenty of resentment.
Mm-hmm. If you'd had a resentment, if you'd kept that resentment, how would that have changed things? What would that do to you? What would that have done?
Well, I don't think you can grow and have resentments. I mean, I just don't think you can. I think it just burns a hole in you. I mean,
right. That's
like, you know, that whole thing of forgiveness, you know, and you forgive other people, but it doesn't really matter. A lot of times it's what you have to do it so that you can be free, you know.
See, what I'm thinking is that there's so many people out there. We live in a culture where, you know, revenge is like, you know, worshipped almost, you know, in the movies and all of that stuff. And yet we're sitting here talking about forgiveness and loving people that aren't particularly nice to you and may not even love you back, you know, and it seems to me that there's probably a lot of people that would say, well, why would you go through all that? I mean, I might understand, but I wonder if people really understand why you would do that.
The other stuff is, I just feel like it's a low-level approach, the other stuff. And it comes out of a, you know, a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book a couple years ago, a lady, Jill Bolte Taylor, who had a stroke. She was a Harvard brain scientist. And when she was going back to do her rehab, she said, you know, there's things about my personality I don't want to be. I want to be, you know, loving, I want to be irritable, I want to be this or that. And she said, she took the word responsibility and she chopped it up. And she said, I want to increase my ability to respond. I don't think much grows if there isn't, you know, that kind of vulnerability, willingness to change.
And I guess maybe that's the thing, is that when you grow up the way you did, you got to go one way or the other. You don't have a lot of choices. If you're going to survive and grow, you got to go to forgiveness.
And you do what
that's the gift, you know.
You do what you have to do, but I think the core of us really is love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really who we are, and we're meant to be. And I think once, you know, you start going to programs, you know, meetings and stuff like that, and I know it sounds kind of corny, but really, you start, you know, that no matter who you are, you may not like all of us, but you love us in a very special way. You know? But you do, you say, oh my gosh, you know. Okay,
you find that out, right?
She wouldn't talk so much, but oh my gosh, what she said.
She wouldn't talk about that again, but
here we go. Yeah. But there is, you see it, and you learn to walk in, and you start getting that from other people, like your needs met, really.
Do you feel like you've gotten through your sadnesses or your disappointments about things? Do you have regrets?
I have a lot of them.
Yeah,
I do. And I'm not a person who is believes in a resolution model that you're done.
Mm-hmm.
You're good. I'm done. No, I think it's the life journey, and there's grief.
Yeah.
Grief work is forever, and it shows up. You know, I would say I'm reasonably happy in my life, really.
Mm-hmm.
Made a snowman the other day. That was me and my inner child.
Did you ride your horse recently?
Oh, you know, I almost did today. But the ground was slick.
Yeah.
Cross-country skiing wiped out a few times instead. But, you know, you just, I don't know, got to be...
That's part of the deal, is what you're saying. The sadness, the disappointments, the regrets.
I go with it. And, you know, my sister died. It'll be 2 years this month from addiction. No, I'm just coming out of the woods with that grief. And regrets, a million. A million. And what are you going to do about it? You know, try to love the next person in front of me better. You know, just keep trying to do it better. You know, but yeah, I don't think you just can shut it down and say it doesn't matter. I mean, you do make your amends, do your program, make your amends. You own what's yours to own, but you know, you got to start making love the next person, do it better.
What would you say to a kid if you had contact with a kid that was in a situation like you were when you were 10 years old, what would you tell them?
Well, first of all, don't believe what they say about your self-worth.
Right.
Because that is just so damaging to little kids. You know, I know a guy who used to come to meetings. And I admired the way he did this. You know, he'd always introduce himself and he'd say, my name is, and I am a beautiful child of God. And I would say, I mean, at first I thought, well, that's kind of hokey, come on, you know, but I was really in the program, right?
Right.
But, you know, this guy was pretty consistent with, I am a beautiful child of God. When I heard his story and heard the stuff that he had done, you know, and how does he say, I am a beautiful child of God, because that is where we come from, our creator, our higher power. I heard a phrase that said our deepest DNA is God, and I love that.
Yeah.
But when he would say that, I'd think, oh my gosh, how does he have the guts to say that? But it's so true. That's what I would want a kid to know. That's still, because I always have to say to myself, what's been damaged and what's intact? And that's the part that's still damaged to me. It's why I have to keep coming back. I am a beautiful child of God. I still have difficulty with that. I mean, some days are better than others.
But that's a good goal to be able to.
That's what I want a little kid to know.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We haven't gotten a whole lot into your family, your marriage. Plural, and marriages and your kids. You've your kids have struggled, or you've had, they've had some struggles with addictions too. So you've had it on this end. You've also struggled on this
mm-hmm.
end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How have you handled that?
Well, it's confusing sometimes. It's overwhelming. I think, come on, it's enough already. We'll just go to the happy ending, you know. And when I look at my program, it's like, am I looking at it from the child? Am I looking at it from being the spouse, the sibling of, or the mother of? And I have to say, being the mother of an addict has been the hardest part.
Has it?
Yeah.
What's been the, why has it been the hardest? The most heartache? The most...
Well, you know, you always want to do it better than was done, you know. I feel like my kids were very much raised in a similar situation because of my former spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have wounds and scars, and they don't have a program and don't have an interest in it. So, I mean, we see those behaviors from people who don't buy into the 12-step program, and they don't know about it, and it's painful. It's painful for me.
Is it more painful that for you because you do have it, that and you can see how much they don't?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's the fun thing about but you know, you get so excited when you see like how life can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the beauty in it. You know?
Right, and you obviously see it. You know,
the promises. You know?
Yeah.
Boy, we will know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will comprehend the word serenity. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Well, why wouldn't you want to give? Why wouldn't anybody want that? You know,
right.
You want to give that to people. And, you know, my sponsor always talks about, you know, I used to try to, you know, 12-step people. You know? But you want to do that. You
right.
want them to have that. You want them to have a relationship with God, higher power. You want them to know their worth.
Sure. It's hard to understand why somebody wouldn't want the beauty of what you have. If there was something... And maybe you've already answered this earlier, but if there's something that you could tell the little Julie inside now, is there anything that you would tell her or like to remind her about?
I think that you're enough. You are enough. You know, I think that's... that was pretty damaging. I've mm-hmm. always felt like I'm not good enough. You know, this is going to sound like that Stuart Smiley. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not pretty enough. I mean, that's it. And, you know, that's what I would like myself to know and have that. But I have to, you know, that kind of damage takes this kind of work.
Yeah, and maybe Stuart Smiley wasn't. That might have been funny, but it might have been a pretty good thing for him to be doing every day.
Yeah.
To look in the mirror and tell himself those things.
Yeah, and that's why I have to keep coming back.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a done deal. I still have a lot of work to do.
We're probably pretty close to needing to close, and I know that you had, we were going to do one last,
mm-hmm.
it's a song, not a poem. This
right.
is a song you wrote that you're going to read.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so tell us about that, and then go ahead with it.
Okay. This was, I call it country recovery song, and it really does have a country twang to it. I write,
should we hum along, or?
Yeah. Stomp your foot if you want.
No.
Okay.
And this, I think I had my mom in mind for this one. I wrote this. And it says... Now, I know you never knew me or what was on my mind. I know you never knew it, but you almost ruined my life. But I am growing, and I'm leaving it behind. I am headed for a new peace of mind. And then the chorus goes, down the highway, I can see it. And I never would believe it, but I'm going home. And I think that's because I was working on the Bradshaw stuff,
mm-hmm.
homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
You know that I don't blame you. In fact, I understand. that there is a private roadway inside of every man, and we all are travelers, and nobody knows the way, but we all can learn from the pain on the way, down the highway. I can see it, and I never would believe it, but I'm going home. And now we all are brothers. Before I could not see, I only saw the distance and the road in front of me. I only saw my weakness, and I only felt the tears, and I only felt the anger of so many wasted years. Down the highway, I can see it, and I never would believe it, but I'm going home. I'm going home. I just also wanted to say, and then why do I like the slogan, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens? Because addiction makes you want to run and hide and pretend. Everybody in my family except for my brother, they're all dead. It's just me and him now. It's serious. It's really serious. But if you stay, a miracle will happen. Promises, they're not maybes. They are promises, and I am a miracle. The statistics say that my life should look different than what it is. Well, I say the miracle is me, and I owe my life to the 12 steps and the God who inspired them and Bill Wilson, and I will forever be a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Thank you. Thank you, Julie. You are a miracle. Yeah. So don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens.
Don't
got that, everybody? Just don't do it. Great story. I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming, Julie. Thanks for your story. It was a good one. And I also want to thank our listeners and our studio audience for being here, for helping to make us a successful little underground support source for the recovering community. We'll email our reminders for next week's show. And as always, we'll look at recovery from a wide and open perspective. Remember to check recoveryinternetradio.com for all the archive shows. I think we've said that 3 times now.
Recoveryinternetradio.com?
I think that's the one, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And to sign up for our email reminder list, if you'd like a reminder, we'd be happy to send you one. We need your email. We'd like to hear from you so we know where our listeners are. We've had over 30,000 of you now, and so we really appreciate our listeners and would like to hear from you. So as always, live today, love yourself and your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We'll see you at 8 p.m. next Sunday night.
Thank you.
Thanks. Nice job.